Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. This week in the news, horror in Las Vegas, the worst mass shooting in modern U.S. history, carnage and chaos everywhere.
He was shooting everybody, and there was dead people everywhere, and I don't even know what was happening. He was just shooting randomly.
Rex Tillerson, still on the job, but on the ropes.
Could you address the main headline of this story that you called the president a moron? And if not, where do you think these reports are?
I'm not going to deal with petty stuff like that. I mean, this is what I don't understand about Washington.
And President Trump visits Puerto Rico.
I hate to tell you, Puerto Rico, but you've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Margaret Brennan of CBS News, Stephen Henderson of the Detroit Free Press, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online. How are you processing Las Vegas? Beyond bump stocks, is it time for Congress to act on guns or not? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining this hour, a great panel from Washington First, Margaret Brennan, White House and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for CBS News. Margaret, great to have you.
Great to speak with you.
From WDET in Detroit, Stephen Henderson joins us, columnist and editorial page editor at the Detroit Free Press, host of WDET's Detroit Today. Stephen Henderson, great to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty, as always, joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Jane, Stephen, and Margaret.
Well, we begin in Las Vegas in the horror of the shooting that left 59 people dead, including the gunman, and hundreds seriously wounded. Here is Russell Bleck, a witness of Sunday's mass shooting, telling NBC about the chaos that he saw.
You did not know where the shots were coming from. There's just no telling. And then it would echo throughout the whole, area. So nobody knew where to go, and then all of a sudden a couple people would run away from a safe area, but you didn't know if it was safe. I mean, it was just absolute chaos and carnage.
Stephen Henderson, a lot is still unknown about this shooting. Are investigators any closer to pinpointing a motive here?
I don't think they are. I think this shooter fits none of the profiles that we typically think of when we think of people who do things like this. We know that that now that he was sort of spiraling down emotionally, but there doesn't seem to be a trigger that we can point to yet. And I think that's one of the real cultural frustrations that surrounds this. We like to be able to explain things like this, to be able to say to ourselves, well, maybe we are still safe. Maybe we are not as at risk for these things as we may appear. But that we don't seem to be able to reach that level of comfort here yet because we just don't know enough about Stephen Paddock or his motives.
The shooter, Stephen Paddock, his girlfriend, Mary Lou Danley, returned from the Philippines this week to be questioned by investigators. NBC News reporting that Danley told them Paddock would lie in bed, quote, just moaning and screaming, and that he displayed, quote, mental health symptoms. Also reported this week that Paddock may have scouted other locations, including Fenway Park here in Boston, Lollapalooza in Chicago, and another music festival in Las Vegas before checking into the Mandalay Bay. Margaret Brennan, investigators under a lot of pressure to produce some answers here soon.
They're under a lot of pressure to produce answers, but I don't know that there will be necessarily any major legislative responses or any major change here, at least that we've heard of, other than this general willingness to look at the device that shooter used to turn his semi-automatic weapon into one that was nearly fully automatic. Otherwise, that kind of weaponry is not legally purchased. It's something really meant for the military and its usage. So when you come out of these things, when I was standing on the White House North Lawn as all of this reaction was breaking, it has become almost a rote response to have the flag lowered to half staff, to have the president go visit the site, visit the victims, comfort them, turn the page, and we wait for this to happen again. And here in Washington, there is a sense of resignation. I wouldn't say there's a large sense of momentum, though we will perhaps, as the White House said yesterday, they're open to talking about banning this device, this so-called bump stock device.
Yeah. Here is President Trump. Before we get to that, Margaret, here he is in Las Vegas offering the support of the American people to those who have been affected by the Las Vegas shooting.
We know that your sorrow feels endless. We stand together to help you carry your pain. You're not alone. We will never leave your side.
Jack Beatty, the gunman, had meticulous planning. He had been stockpiling guns for decades, but no social media footprint, no manifesto to be found. A lot here we may never understand.
Yes, but according to his inamorata, waking up in the morning and screaming. So clearly, the president, you know, said he's a sick man, demented. Yet, ironically, one of the few pieces of legislation President Trump has signed was a measure from the Republican Congress that essentially would allow people who are mentally incapacitated to buy guns, SSI recipients who can't manage their own affairs. That was something that seemed an intolerable interference with their liberty to the National Rifle Association, and the president has said to the Rifle Association, you came through for me, $30 million to his campaign, and I'm going to come through for you. And in that bill, allowing 75,000 recipients, SSI recipients, who can't manage their own affairs to buy guns, he certainly came through for them.
Margaret, you mentioned bump stocks. Many people were introduced to the obscure gun conversion device this week. That's what, of course, the gunman used in Las Vegas. Bump stocks, they turn semi-automatic weapons into weapons capable of firing in long, deadly spurts. On Wednesday, Democratic Senator Dianne Feinstein of California introduced a bill that would outlaw the sale and possession of bump stocks. At a press conference, here she is listing mass shootings that have stunned the nation: Columbine, Virginia Tech, Tucson, Aurora. And then she continued.
After Sandy Hook, when 20 first graders were slaughtered, I thought for sure we would act. After Orlando, I thought we would act. And now, after Las Vegas, I hope senators will finally summon the political courage to stand up and say, enough is enough.
And here's House Speaker Paul Ryan on Thursday during an interview on MSNBC saying he is open to holding a vote on banning bump stocks.
I didn't even know what they were until this week, and I'm an avid sportsman. So I think we're quickly coming up to speed with what this is. Fully automatic weapons have been banned for a long time. Apparently, this allows you to take a semi-automatic, turn it into fully automatic. So clearly, that's something we need to look into.
Something we need to look into. Stephen Henderson, do you think the Las Vegas shooting may lead Washington to approach gun control in a different way?
Well, I think the coalescing of sort of discussion around these bump stocks is probably the most significant advancement in discussion about gun legislation in, I don't know, what, 20, 30 years. I mean, it is pretty remarkable that you have even the NRA saying, yeah, let's think about how to manage these things. And if we can get to that space and get to the point where there's legislation dealing with it, I think it's also a tremendous opportunity to expand beyond that, right? It's not just bump stocks that are the problem. High-capacity magazines, for instance. I think there are people who are starting to think about why you ought to be able to buy those and not have to reload a weapon before you get 30 shots off. I also want to interject something in the conversation here that I've been bothered by this week, which is the narrative of mental illness, which I think is a very serious problem and relates to the gun issue. But, you know, most people who struggle with mental illness never do the things that Stephen Paddock did. And so I think it's sort of insufficient explanation for this. You look at other countries, too. I mean, there's mental illness is not unique to the United States. There's lots of people who struggle with mental illness who never get to this point. I think that becomes something of a crutch in the conversation and gets us away from talking about what makes these things possible. And that is the guns. It is the type of gun and the proliferation and distribution of those guns. That's what we really need to be focused on.
So, Jack Beatty, that's an interesting point, because Congress has typically approached these mass shootings from a mental health perspective, if you will. What do you see this time?
I think it's going to be very difficult to get perhaps even the bump stock, but we'll have to see. Because, you know, the NRA, which came out saying, yes, we want bump stocks looked at, they mean administratively. They mean bureaucratically. They mean the Bureau of Alcohol and Tobacco and Firearms. They want them to look at the regulations. They don't want this debated in Congress. So we'll have to see whether that happens. But even if it does happen, that may be a beachhead that can't be surpassed, because with gun control, we have a paradigm, or the gun issue, of one of the structural elements of American politics. We are what the authors of a new book, One Nation After Trump, calls a non-majoritarian democracy. And gun control shows that, where, you know, in the Sandy Hook gun limitation vote, the 54 yes votes represented 63% of the population. The 46 no votes, 37%. They won. That's non-majoritarian democracy, sustained partly by campaign contributions, but we also have to face it, sustained by a kind of gun culture. I read the other day that there are more gun clubs than McDonald's in the country. And the feeling in rural white America that this is just part of their identity. This is a rooted, deep-rooted problem.
Margaret Brennan, just about 30 seconds before the break here, but the NRA issued a statement this week saying that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms should, quote, review the issue of bump stocks. So the ATF is part of the executive branch, right? The NRA is not suggesting that Congress take up this issue, correct, Margaret?
Right. They were blaming President Obama for the ATF during his time in office not banning them. So they're making it partisan here. I do think it's remarkable, though, that had that shooter had any kind of ties to an international terrorist group, I think this conversation would be sharply different and there would be calls for action. And that is not where we are going now. We're talking about trimming around the edges to regulate a device, not a weapon.
This podcast and the following message are sponsored by Blue Apron. Blue Apron partners with sustainable farms, fisheries, and ranchers to bring you everything you need to create incredible home-cooked meals. Ingredients come pre-measured, so there's no food waste, and it's delivered right to your door. Rediscover how fun cooking can be while enjoying seasonally inspired recipes and exploring new flavors and cuisines. No commitment. Get the meals only when you want. Get your first three Blue Apron meals free, plus free shipping, by visiting blueapron.com/OP.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about a big week in the news, and you can join the conversation. Should Rex Tillerson stick around? Should the president decertify the Iran nuclear deal? What do you make of his calm before the storm comment? We've got a great panel to go through the news with us this week. Margaret Brennan, White House and senior foreign affairs correspondent for CBS News. Stephen Henderson, columnist and editorial page editor at the Detroit Free Press and host of WDET's Detroit Today, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. Let's hear from Republican Congressman Steve Scalise here, speaking with NBC's Chuck Todd during an interview on Thursday. He's just back from work, Steve Scalise is, after he was shot in June during practice for an annual congressional baseball game, saying that the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms should review bump stocks, not necessarily Congress.
Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi already said she wants it to be a slippery slope. She doesn't want to stop at bump stocks. They want to go out and limit the rights of gun owners. And so I do think it's a little bit early for people to say they know what to do to fix this problem. I know there are people that are asking the ATF to go back and review their 2010 decision to authorize it. And I think they should, and they are.
In 2010, as a review here, the ATF authorized bump stocks, saying that they did not violate federal law. And then on Thursday, of course, as we said, the NRA called on the ATF to review that assessment. A couple of callers that want to get in here on this point. Kevin first from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma. Hi, Kevin. You're on the air.
Hi. I'm part of the comment that was made, the rural white America. And as they said, you know, guns are a way of life. It's a matter of respect, understanding how to use them, and such. And legislation cannot stop the lone gunman, no matter how you try. If we did a gun buyback, something like Australia, we got a third of the guns back, we'd still have 200, 250 million weapons in America, guns. And it's not the guns that kill people, it's the people who use them. It's the breakdown of society. Additionally, if we're going to address it, we need to address it on a state-by-state basis, because certain states, certain areas, much more dense populated, have others. Different needs.
Kevin, thank you. Thanks for that call and that perspective. Let me get another in here. Graham in Austin, Texas. Hi, Graham. You're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, Jane. Thanks. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to say that it's a shame that they're really focusing on the whole bump stock issue, because, like you already said, NRA already came out and endorsed, sure, we'll get rid of those. And I think they're behind doors laughing that Democrats, Republicans are going to let this pass. They're going to ban bump stocks. It's not really going to change anything in terms of the gun culture and the amount of, mass shootings in America. It's such a minor issue, and they're going to let that pass because, they'll get a pat on their back and think they did something good, but in reality, they really did nothing.
Graham, thank you. A lot of callers and listeners on one from our website contributing here. One thing that was typical after this shooting that was seen before was the cry that, quote, this is not the time to discuss gun control. Is a country that averages one mass shooting a day, when will it ever be time to discuss gun control? Well, we shall see. We will follow this, of course, in the days and weeks to come. Let's move to Puerto Rico now. Puerto Rico still recovering after Hurricane Maria. 9% of electricity has been restored to the island so far, according to FEMA. President Trump headed there on Tuesday.
You've thrown our budget a little out of whack because we've spent a lot of money on Puerto Rico, and that's fine. We've saved a lot of lives. If you look at the every death is a horror, but if you look at a real catastrophe like Katrina, and you look at the tremendous hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of people that died, and you look at what happened here with really a storm that was just totally overpowering. Nobody's ever seen anything like this.
Puerto Rico's official death toll, for the record, is now 34, according to the governor of Puerto Rico on Wednesday. Margaret Brennan, reaction here to President Trump's trip to Puerto Rico.
Well, look, this is the president doing something that he feels is necessary for the executive, which is to be on the ground and look and feel and talk to the people. He's emphasized, I'm coming. It took so long for Puerto Rico to be able to even have the kind of infrastructure to have a presidential visit, but I don't know that there was a net gain to him making that appearance, because the way he interacted, some of the comments that he made about the cost of the devastation, hurting the budget, the tossing of supplies to those gathered to receive some of those items being given away in a photo op, all of that was heavily criticized. A lot of people criticized the president for a lack of empathy. I think, if anything, he felt very unfairly treated during that crisis, which you saw him lash out at in a personal way via Twitter at the mayor of San Juan, at the leadership there. And he repeatedly emphasized the personal, talking about my reaction, how I have covered this, how my administration has handled this has really been a great success. So the president was clearly frustrated with the media's focus on the devastation in Puerto Rico rather than grading the response of the federal response in a more positive way. And it's not clear that was in any way meant to be a criticism other than the devastation has been such, and the calls for help to move more quickly and to, in some ways, get things there faster, that we're slow to get to people now. We're talking about the island may not have full electricity for another year. This is going to be an ongoing issue. There was another misstep on the part of the president this week when he, unprompted in a Fox News interview, suggested that Puerto Rico's debt would be wiped out and said, we'll have to talk to whoever owns that. Maybe it's Goldman Sachs. The next day, the director of the OMB here at the White House had to walk that back, saying, no, we're not bailing out Puerto Rico. And I don't know why the president mentioned Goldman Sachs, but I can promise you the federal government will be sending aid. So what was meant to be an effort to
console and to help in Puerto Rico didn't necessarily end that way from a PR standpoint for the president this week.
Here's the mayor to whom you referred, Margaret, Mayor Carmen Yulin Cruz of San Juan. She told the Rachel Maddow Show that she took offense to the president's visit.
He was insulting to the people of Puerto Rico. He said something like, Puerto Rico, you really have taken our budget out of whack because of all the money we've thrown here. He kind of minimized our suffering here by saying that Katrina was a real disaster, sort of implying that this was not a real disaster because not many people have died here. Well, you know what? They're dying.
Stephen Henderson, it was reported today by the Washington Post that FEMA has removed information about the federal response in Puerto Rico from its website. Also removed from its website statistics about the number of Puerto Ricans who currently have drinking water and electricity, which as of Wednesday was only half of the island had drinking water and 5% had electricity. What do you make of that? And what do you know about the federal recovery efforts? How do you think they're going?
Well, I think it hasn't been great. I don't think anybody objectively can look at it and say that it's been what Puerto Rico needs. Now, there are a lot of reasons for that. It's very difficult to get to the island. There was some difficulty around the Jones Act and relaxing that, although it should have probably been done earlier by the president. You know, the thing that strikes me about the president's visit and the things he said there that really stand out, when he probably had no idea how much truth he was speaking when he said that Puerto Rico was going to break the budget. This is an island that has gone through a very significant federal restructuring of its debt and obligations, very similar to the one that we went through here in Detroit. We emerged from that situation with a lot of optimism about what was possible. Puerto Rico emerged from that with a lot of questions about what its future could look like. Investment on the island is way down. Population on the island is decreasing. There wasn't, even before the storm, a whole lot to look at to say, you know, Puerto Rico is going to be in a better place in 5 or 10 years than it is today. You add on top of all of that the massive repair and cleanup effort that we will now have to undertake. I mean, the burden on the federal government, not just to fix what got broken in Puerto Rico by the storm, but to encourage growth and economic fortune for the people there is you are talking about billions and billions of dollars, I think, in order to get that going. And the question will be whether this administration feels that that's something worth doing and that it could have a payoff down the road.
Let's get Monica in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Monica. You're on the air.
Hi, Jane.
Hi. Go ahead.
I think that the reason that it has been slow getting supplies and effort to Puerto Rico is because the people there are brown. I think it's racism.
Oh, dear. Okay, Monica, thank you. Jack Beatty, your response and your thoughts about Puerto Rico.
I think what Monica meant was that we're not hurrying on that account. And, you know, really, the couple of the tweets the president sent over the weekend pointed in that direction, didn't they? He seemed to be saying these people are shiftless. They can't take care of themselves. And the NPR reporter on the ground said, in fact, all the recovery that she could see was through self-help. People banding together and trying to get water brigades and everything they needed. It was all community involvement. And the president is saying, well, they can't help themselves. That does fit in, unfortunately, to a terrible racial stereotype. And I think the president traded on that. And I think his reaction in Puerto Rico underlined that. And, you know, His narcissism is almost seismic. He reacts to things that wouldn't bother other people, wouldn't think they're about him. This isn't about him. He didn't have to personalize this. This is a great human tragedy, and yet such is his insecurity. Everything becomes, oh my God, I'm doing a great job, aren't I? It borders on the pathetic.
Let's turn now to Rex Tillerson. This week, the Secretary of State held a press conference in response to a story by NBC, which he said which they said he had considered resigning this summer amid tensions with the White House. Here he is on Wednesday, Secretary of State Tillerson, saying he is absolutely not resigning.
There's never been a consideration in my mind to leave. I serve at the appointment of the president, and I'm here for as long as the president feels I can be useful to achieving his objectives.
Margaret Brennan, quite unusual for a Secretary of State to hold a press conference like that. What's the backstory?
It's extraordinary for a Secretary of State to hold a press conference to pledge his loyalty to the president, particularly a Secretary of State like Rex Tillerson, who is so extraordinarily press-averse that he avoids the press at virtually all costs. This was a hastily put together press conference simply because of that news report. And Rex Tillerson was largely focused on for what he didn't say, which was not issuing a strong denial of having derisively referred to the president. Specifically, used more the phrase moron is what NBC reported. Look, I mean, what we know is at that time in July, Tillerson was in a really tough place with the administration. They went through a really knockdown, drag-out fight with the president over whether or not to continue to stand by the Iran nuclear deal. There was deep frustration. The president didn't make quick decisions on the Afghanistan strategy review. That was a painful one for him. That got dragged out over time. The secretary was frustrated. He was cut out of decisions on sanctions on Venezuela. What we know as clear fact is that he has been deeply frustrated as a Secretary of State. He has been harshly criticized from the outside, from most of Washington, even those who at the time had high expectations for the Exxon's CEO to be able to really stand on the global stage and represent the United States. He has been repeatedly challenged publicly by the president, undercutting him on policy pronouncements just as recently as this weekend when it came to Tillerson pushing and reasserting it wasn't news, but saying, yes, we are trying to talk to North Korea. The president quickly came out and said, don't waste your time. No, we're not. It is hard to imagine that the secretary can walk into a room with any world leader and have the strength of the negotiating power of the United States behind him, or any assumption that he truly speaks for the president right now because of this perception. This is something that the president has really put him in a tough place on. But what I will say is that those around him say he's chugging on. He continues to do his work. There's no immediate sign that he will be departing. Whether or not the president wants to continue to have him as an administration is unclear, though he said he has full confidence. He was very angry in the morning on Wednesday morning and said by the end of the day that he's going to continue working with Rex Tillerson.
Let's get David in here on this from Hartsville, Tennessee. Hi, David. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Jane.
Hello.
You know, while I totally agree with Rex Tillerson, I do not want him to leave. We need somebody with a little bit of experience and knowledge about world affairs, and the leader we have is totally over his head, just lost.
David, thank you. To that point, let me get some sound in here from Republican Senator Bob Corker of Tennessee. He took a dig at the president and threw some support towards some of his cabinet members, including Rex Tillerson.
Secretary Tillerson, Secretary Mattis, and Chief of Staff Kelly are those people that help separate our country from chaos.
Wow. Stephen Henderson, that's quite a statement from the powerful Republican senator from Tennessee.
Yeah, yeah. Very, very damning of this presidency. And I think we're starting to see more of this inside the Republican Party. You think of the people who have stood up and said they're not going to seek re-election for their seats in Congress, Republicans, many of them expressing real frustration about the way this administration has worked with Congress and in particular with Republicans. Dave Trott, a congressman from right here in Michigan, is among those who has said he's had enough and he's only been there two terms, but he feels like he can't get anywhere. I think really soon we're going to start to see this sort of reckoning, a real reckoning inside the Republican Party of the effect of such a dissonance from the White House toward congressional Republicans. I can't think of the last time we've seen something like this, but it really is shaking that idea of party cohesion and loyalty at its foundations. And someone like Bob Corker, you know, again, that's not just your run-of-the-mill Republican representative. I mean, this is a prominent figure in the party and has nothing good to say about this presidency.
Jack Beatty, last 20 seconds. You get the last word on this.
I think Bob Corker is preparing to run against the president in the primaries of 2020.
Okay. Well, that explains that.
Yeah.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. In other news this week, Carolina Panthers quarterback Cam Newton fumbles after dismissing a question from a female sports reporter.
Devin Funchess has seemed to really embrace the physicality of his routes and making getting those extra yards. Does that give you a little bit of an enjoyment to see him kind of truck sticking people out there?
It's funny to hear a female talk about routes. Like, it's funny.
Let's Make a Deal legend Monty Hall died this week at 96.
This is Let's Make a Deal, where we dispense more fun per cubic minute than anywhere else in television. And the first deal is going to involve a married couple named Mabel. Now that's funny. Wouldn't it be funny if your first name was Mabel? Then you'd be Mabel Mabel.
And the great rock and roll icon Tom Petty died this week at 66. From his solo debut album, here's Free Fallin'. You can join the conversation, listeners, this hour. What are you thinking about Facebook, about Russia, Equifax, Cam Newton, Harvey Weinstein? Great panel this hour. Margaret Brennan, White House and Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for CBS News. Stephen Henderson, columnist and editorial page editor at the Detroit Free Press and host of WDET's Detroit Today, and On Point News analyst Jack Beatty. I want to throw this in here during a pre-dinner photo session with his top military and advisors and their spouses. On Thursday, President Trump made this cryptic remark.
You guys know what this represents?
Well,
memories of the calm before the storm.
Lester Stormy.
Could be the calm before the storm.
What storm is
we have the world's great military people in this room. I will tell you that. And we're going to have a great evening. Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.
What storm, Mr. President?
You'll find out.
Margaret Brennan, what does that mean, the calm before the storm? And then the answer, you'll find out.
Well, if this is the calm, I'm afraid of the storm. I'm strapping in for an intense day here at the White House. But it's an extraordinary statement, particularly one when you're standing next to all the military leaders, the combatant commanders and their spouses, and you've called in the press to take a photo of you saying that without explaining any context. It's something that is clearly meant by the president to exude strength, in his view, that is strength. To speak in that way, to send a message, but it's not clear who the message is aimed at exactly, because there are a number of fronts with some ratcheting of tension right now. One of them clearly in Asia with North Korea, where you've had the president make clear that he thinks, since North Korea continues to not respond in any positive way to American overtures for a diplomatic resolution to the standoff here, that he increasingly thinks that he's going to have to look at some of those worst choice conclusions, perhaps using military force in some way against Kim Jong-un and his regime. Right now, the diplomatic option that the White House focuses on is not diplomatic talks, but rather trying to cut off North Korea's access to money to build out their nuclear arsenal further. But immediately what we are looking at is this October 15th U.S. law requirement that President Trump sign off on certifying whether or not Iran continues to abide by the terms of the nuclear agreement that the U.S. entered into with Iran and a number of other world powers. And from my own reporting, what I know is that the national security team has advised the president to stick with the deal, don't blow it up,
don't deliver on that part of the campaign promise. Try to keep the architecture of this deal that freezes Iran's nuclear program, but look at other ways to confront its meddling in the Middle East, its funding of terrorist groups, and its being a bad actor on other fronts. But this is going to be a gamble in many ways for the Trump administration to go this route, because the president is opening up a clear path for Congress to charge ahead with putting sanctions back on Iran in a way that could put the U.S. in violation of the deal and quickly unravel it. Every partner to that deal, including Russia and China, is advising the president not to go this route. His own national security team has advised him not to go this route. And what you have is behind the scenes his national security team going to Congress and saying, we're going to hand you this loaded gun, this ability to put sanctions back on Iran, but we're going to ask you not to do it. And you're going to work with us, give us more time, and hopefully we can get a new add-on diplomatic deal that resolves some of these issues. That's what the president's laying the groundwork for. That may be what he was hinting at last night in those comments.
In fact, here is Secretary of Defense Jim Mattis telling the Senate Armed Services Committee on Tuesday this week that he believes the U.S. should remain in the Iran deal. He said that he considers the nuclear pact as being in the interest of the national security of the United States.
If we can confirm that Iran is living by the agreement, if we can determine that this is in our best interest, then clearly we should stay with it. I believe at this point in time, absent indications to the contrary, it is something the president should consider staying with.
But Margaret Brennan, it sounds like he may not, in sending signals that he will indeed decertify the Iran nuclear deal. So what does that mean, and what would happen next?
Right. Well, the very top national security advisors, I should make clear, Mattis, Tillerson, H.R. McMaster, and even the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, General Dunford, have said to the president, stick with this deal. It's not a friendship agreement, but it's in the best national security interest to keep Iran's nuclear deal frozen. Let's see what else we can do to rein them in. The outlier there would be the U.N. Ambassador Nikki Haley, who has welcomed one of the political solutions, you could call it, or proposals from a hardliner in Congress, Senator Tom Cotton, who has laid out what he sees as a clear way for Congress to hold out the threat of sanctioning Iran and say this is going to be something that compels the rest of the world to act and agree to fix, quote-unquote, some of the issues with the Obama-era nuclear deal. You know, when the centrifuges can start spinning and what happens after this so-called sunset, after 10 years' time. All those things that the Obama administration knew were going to become problems but thought they'd deal with when they got there, the president is going to, if he goes ahead with this decertification, manufacture a crisis in some way and say, no, we're going to deal with it right now. The gamble here is that Iran says there's no renegotiating and the other partners in the deal have not agreed yet to sit down and do this separate deal. And it also puts a lot of power in the hands of Congress, because it requires that Congress do what the president and his advisors are telling them to do, which is not to act on sanctions yet and to work with them on when to exert this pressure and when to hold back. So it requires a certain amount of coordination that we haven't yet seen the administration be able to do with this Congress. Not saying it won't work, but it is a gamble. And that is what we are bracing for. And our allies, the ambassadors from Germany, France, and the UK were all on Capitol Hill meeting with Congress to sort of sketch out, okay, how are we going to manage this fallout, and urging the president not to go this route.
All right. We will keep watching, of course. I want to move on now to news about Nancy Pelosi. A senior House Democrat this week said that it's time for the House Minority Leader, Nancy Pelosi, and two top lieutenants to prepare to step down and make way for the next generation of lawmakers in her caucus. Here she is on C-SPAN in an interview. Representative Linda Sanchez, vice chair of the Democratic caucus. That means she's the fifth highest ranking member in the House, breaking ranks with leadership, calling for a generational change.
I think that it's time to pass the torch to a new generation. They are all of the same generation. And again, their contributions to the Congress and to the caucus are substantial. But I think there comes a time when you need to pass that torch, and I think it's time.
Stephen Henderson, Pelosi, 77, Steny Hoyer, 78, James Clyburn, 77, many years of service there. A lot of people saying that Sanchez is voicing what others are just thinking in Washington.
Yeah, well, and I think the question is, what is the future of the Democratic Party? What does it look like in terms of leadership? I think it's also an expression of frustration with the current leadership and its ability to move the ball. Now, of course, they're in the minority in both houses. You can't get a whole lot done from that position. But over the span of time that Pelosi and Hoyer and others have been in leadership, what's the outcome been? What has been the moving of the ball, I guess, on the Democratic agenda? And I think that's a totally legitimate question to ask, and I think it's a totally legitimate discussion to have at this point. We're coming into midterm elections. If Democrats can't take back one of those houses, they're going to be in for just as tough a time in the second half of this presidency as they were in the first term. So I think it makes a lot of sense to try to think about whether it's time for Pelosi to step aside for someone else. The question that isn't answered, of course, is who would be next.
Let's get Tripp in here from Nashville, Tennessee. Hi, Tripp. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane. Thanks for taking my call. Mm-hmm. I actually called a couple of weeks ago after Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer met with Donald Trump to broker a deal on DACA and the debt limit, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
This happened weeks after Charlottesville when Republican leaders were fighting off demands calling for the president's resignation. And, you know, Bob Corker, my senator, publicly questioned the competence of the president. And this was the point that the Democratic leadership thought it was a good time to cross the aisle. It was absolutely dumbfounding to me that they thought, A, that they should do this, but B, that it was something to be proud of.
Hmm.
I was completely dumbfounded by it, and I would like to see Nancy Pelosi, if she wants to remain in power, if she could take some kind of public stance towards a public mental health reform bill. I believe that would address the opioid crisis.
Mm-hmm. Otherwise, do you want to see her step down as the leader of the House Democrats?
For sure.
Okay.
Definitely.
Tripp, thank you very much for the call. We're discussing the week in the news. I'm Jane Clayson. This is On Point. Let's get Nate in here from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Hi, Nate. Welcome to On Point.
Hi. Thank you.
Yes.
I'm calling from Wisconsin, where the main unelected body making decisions for my state actually comes in the state legislature. And because it ceased to be Democratic when it rigged its own elections, and this state, or the U.S. Supreme Court, is actually in a position to fix that and return us to a democracy and even support, enhance its own reputation, I think, by establishing a standard so that no party can undermine democracy to serve itself and its own interests.
It's a good question. I'm glad you brought it up, Nate, because I wanted to get to this. Jack Beatty, you've been interested in this this week, this important case before the Supreme Court about the future of partisan gerrymandering. Big implications here.
Huge, and crucially, Anthony Kennedy, it really is in some sense the Kennedy Court, is at the center of it. In a 2004 case, Justice Kennedy was chary about intervening in gerrymandering cases. He said doing so would amount to an unprecedented intervention in the American political process. That was then. Now, his questioning of the principals in the Wisconsin case led experts to say, oh, it looks like he's going to be with the liberals on this one, if you judge by his questioning, and perhaps throwing over either a narrowly tailored decision, Wisconsin's way of doing it is wrong, or something more sweeping. If it's something more sweeping, and political gerrymandering is rendered unconstitutional because it's a violation of equal protection or whatever the standard is, that could have immense implications. For example, one estimate is that absent Republican gerrymandering, the Democrats would have won as many as 22 seats, more seats in 2012, and perhaps held on to the House. Another estimate
It says currently about 16 seats are owed to gerrymandering by the GOP. I've been talking about the gun control as an example of our non-majoritarian democracy. This would, throwing over gerrymandering, you know, perhaps even going on the California model and turning it over to a commission, that would go some way, a good way, toward creating a majoritarian democracy.
Nate, thank you very much for the call. Let me get a couple of other items in here. On Wednesday this week, the leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee provided an update on their investigation into Russian interference. Senator Richard Burr said that collusion is still an open question. He also said that the committee agrees with the report that the U.S. intelligence agencies released in January accusing Russia of interfering in the U.S. election.
The Russian intelligence service is determined, clever, and I recommend that every campaign and every election official take this very seriously as we move into this November's election and as we move into preparation for the 2018 election.
And some news about Equifax this week. The former Equifax CEO Richard Smith came under harsh questioning this week at a hearing of the Senate Banking Committee. Democratic Senator Sherrod Brown of Ohio, the Senate Banking Committee's ranking member, said that Equifax has lost America's trust.
This simply is not a company that deserves to be trusted with Americans' personal data. Your actions have exposed over half the country's adults to financial harm.
And this week we got job numbers. Today, actually, we did. The economy lost 33,000 jobs last month. The unemployment rate fell to 4.2%. Economists say the job numbers are down because of the hurricanes, but that the underlying trends, the health of the economy is strong. Margaret Brennan, President Trump says the economy is not getting enough attention.
Well, he really focuses on not so much just the economy, but the sentiment around it that drives the stock market higher. They love here at the White House pointing to that sense of confidence among manufacturers and among the business community, and they see that reflected in the stock market. The reason that's somewhat dangerous is because the stock market can fluctuate. Pointing more to the underlying economic data, past administrations have said, is more telling. Today, because of that dip in employment is being blamed on the storms, I don't know what we're going to hear from the president, if he's going to talk much or tout these numbers quite as much as he has in the past.
Well, a big week, a sad week in many ways. Thanks to this panel for talking us through it. Margaret Brennan, White House Senior Foreign Affairs Correspondent for CBS. Margaret, thanks.
Thank you.
Stephen Henderson from the Detroit Free Press. Stephen, thanks to you.
Thanks for having me.
And Jack Beatty. Thanks so much, Jack. Good weekend.
Thank you.
I'm Jane Clayson, and for Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point.